Mullinger's Weekly Ramble.
It is Wednesday, the 17th of April, 2024, and it is, of course, time for Mullinger's Weekly Ramble with me, your friend, James Mullinger. Thank you all for being here with me. There's a lot to talk about, lots of exciting things, I think mainly because I've been quite busy, busy doing super, super fun things. And I think you can probably all tell when I come on this podcast each week, whether I've had a good week or a bad week, if I'm feeling up or down or dejected or, and I've had a really, really lovely few days, if I'm honest, which I don't feel ashamed to share because often I don't. Before we start, though, I'd like to start with something positive, and hopefully lots of what I talk about today is going to be positive, but this is something which my dear friend Chris Hatt sent me, and it is a quote from Rich Webster, and I think it's a great place to start today's podcast. The quote goes like this: 20 years from now, you'd give anything to be this exact age, exactly this healthy, and back in this exact moment. Now take a second to enjoy it now. What a wonderful outlook. What a wonderful thought to have. That, you know, so often we are kind of either looking forward or wishing things were different, but the reality is that we're going to look back on this time and wish we were here. Maybe not literally here, maybe not going to look back and literally wish you were sat here listening to some annoying British comedian ramble on, but I think we all understand the mantra. So, what have I been up to this week? On Monday night, I went to the Imperial Theatre in St. John. Actually, my second time there in a week. I don't get there as often as I would like, but when I do go, it is always a phenomenally positive and enjoyable experience. I went to see the 1979 Ridley Scott Sigourney Weaver classic Alien on the big screen for the first time in my life. Now, obviously, like most of you, I've seen it numerous times on VHS. And I believe it was probably one of the very first videos, one of the first movies released on VHS. I, of course, being a nerdy collector, still have the original VHS from then, plus multiple different versions of it on VHS. And I think for most of us, watching that movie for the first time, often for many of us when we were quite young, just seeing things like the alien burst through the stomach, we'd never seen anything like that. So it was really interesting going to see the movie now with my oldest son, Hunter, who's 13. And of course, you know, when I was a child, I believe the movie was 18 rated. But of course, now, of course, it does seem very tame. And of course, to him, Ripley is just a Fortnite skin. Although he did recognize both Ripley and the alien from Fortnite. So again, you know, God bless Fortnite for keeping children interested in the things that we used to do when we were kids. But it was amazing seeing it on the big screen with, you know, incredible sound, incredible picture quality. When obviously growing up, we were watching it on kind of scratchy VHSs and it was flickering and you would turn the tracking dial, but it would never make any difference. Whenever you tried to fix the tracking on a VHS, it always just made it worse. But, you know, God bless the Imperial Theatre for, you know, showcasing and programming these classic movies. I mean, I've seen... my wife was lucky enough to go and see Legally Blonde on Galentine's Day. Of course, I mean, it is a classic. That's a classic, but also a classic, modern classic was Boy and the Heron I got to see there. It's just so great being able to get to see classic movies that we always loved. I remember a year ago, I went to see Drunken Master with Jackie Chan. Again, another movie I watched on VHS millions of times on the big screen. So that was, yeah, really, really nice outing on Monday night, getting to see Alien with my son. I was actually at the Imperial last week as well. The day after the solar eclipse day, the day after doing the big show with Colonel Chris Hadfield, my wife and I went to the Imperial to see Candice Bushnell. Of course, the creator or the writer of the Sex and the City book, the real Carrie Bradshaw. I didn't quite realize, I should have realized this. I didn't realize, of course, how female heavy it would be in there, in that, like, I was pretty much, I think, one of the only men in there. There was maybe half a dozen men. I'm a huge Sex and the City fan. I think we're not supposed to think it's cool anymore. Just, you know, my wife and I, when we first met, the show had just come out. I remember taping the very first episode on VHS because I'd read in Heat magazine how great this show was going to be. And when we met and started dating, we absolutely fell in love with the show as we were falling in love with each other. So the Sex and the City has great feelings for us. Even the movies that people purport to not like, we liked. I remember we went to see the first Sex and the City movie with our friends Claire and John in a cinema in Chelsea on a Saturday morning, smuggled in numerous bottles of wine. It was wonderful just sitting in, I was very used to sitting in a dark room on a Saturday morning, drinking bottle after bottle of wine. Very used to that. It was nice to be doing it with other people for a change. And kind of personal, it was a great show. I kind of didn't really know what to expect, but she did a great job, I think, of playing lip service to fans and really giving fans what they wanted. You know, telling us which of the stories from the TV show were real, also sharing her story and her story as a creator, as an entrepreneur, and as a woman who created this thing that became this kind of cultural behemoth. But often, losing one's way in terms of the power that you have over the show, of course, also, signing away the rights for nowhere near enough money, all very, very fascinating. So if you are a fan of Sex and the City, the Candace Bushnell one woman show is highly recommended. And I loved the fact that Candace Bushnell came to the Maritimes. I was in New York just after Christmas, and it was interesting. She was on all the chat shows there talking about going to London and traveling across America. And, good on her for coming to Fredericton, Moncton, St. John, Charlottetown. It was wonderful. One point I should pick up on last week's episode is I went to town a bit on the whole kind of NHL violence in hockey thing, which some people kind of wrote to me saying, oi, oi, easy, easy. And it seemed like I was kind of being a bit sacrilege there, criticizing, violence in the national sport, or indeed maybe the violence in hockey is the national sport in hockey. Anyway, one of the people that picked me up on it was my son, who said that I was a hypocrite for criticizing violence in hockey when I like UFC fighting, which is true. And I guess I take that criticism on the chin. He has a point, although I guess my thing with what I like about boxing and UFC is, of course, it's controlled, it's organized, and they're supposed to fight in there. That's what they're there to do. In hockey, they're not supposed to fight. So And it's all about, the examples that we set as role models and setting examples, especially when you are sporting heroes and superstars. But I am a fan of UFC. And I'm very, very excited by the news that Conor McGregor is back after famously breaking his leg 2-3 years ago. I remember watching that fight live with my friends, the Armstrongs. Devastating moment when Conor McGregor. I have to admit, some people, love him or hate him. I do like Conor McGregor. I mean, I admire someone that has literally worked that hard to get where they are. People are like, oh, he's a bit arrogant. Yeah. But I imagine he probably, you probably need a bit of arrogance to be able to do what he does. He's fighting Andrew Chandler this June. I'm very excited about it. So I did some reading up on UFC because it's very interesting how that brand was built up and how when it started 20 years ago, like famously Senator John McCain, the late John McCain, compared it to human cockfighting. Cockfighting being chicken cocks fighting, not obviously two men swinging there. Yeah. cockfighting now. I've got a visual now. That would be quite interesting because I noticed that Dana White of UFC is trying to bring, or has brought slap, what's it called? Slap fighting in, where people kind of, they slap each other around the face. They take it in turns to slap each other. He's trying to bring that to the cultural forefront. I wonder if cockfighting could ever take off. I'm picturing that now. I will not be able to get that visual out of my head. I'm sure I played it as a child at school at some point, must have had a real life cockfight. But anyway, that, at least that kind of cockfighting is two men consenting to whereas of course cockfighting with chickens is deplorable because the chickens have not consented to. I don't know how I got onto this. We're not even 10 minutes into the podcast. So anyway, my point is that he compared it to human cockfighting, meaning that it's this kind of, you know, deplorable, violent thing. But there's, because you have, and maybe it was that criticism that led to UFC becoming very well controlled and very well medically advised. And as a result, it is an incredibly safe sport, so to speak, in terms of, you know, I mean, an example being, you know, how dangerous boxing is due to the number of blows to the head. You know, someone might receive, you know, up to kind of 400 blows to the head during a boxing fight, whereas, of course, with UFC, you're kind of spreading that violence around. I know it sounds like I'm justifying, it sounds like I'm like a torturer justifying torture. Anyway. I guess my point is that violence or fighting is supposed to be in the Ultimate Fighting Championship. Hockey isn't supposed to be violent. But I said that and my son said, you're wrong. It is supposed to be in it. So that's that. I guess I stand corrected. I was in the at Prince Edward Island this past weekend. I believe on last week's podcast, I was saying how scared I was that no one was going to come to the Summerside tour date. Well, thanks for listening and being kind, because tons of people came out. Nice big room, nice, beautiful, beautiful Scott McCauley Performing Arts Theatre. I've performed there twice before, had an absolute blast. It's at the College of Piping. Amazing that Summerside has two beautiful theatres in it. It has the Harbourfront Theatre and this gorgeous theatre. Thanks to everyone that came out, an absolute blast. And thanks especially to Sarah, who came to the show, sat in the front row with her boyfriend, and afterwards gave me a gift that she had made, which was a wooden keyring with I Love Zellers engraved in it. Thank you, Sarah. You made my day, and nothing like that makes me happier than... I mean, I love doing stand-up, but my favourite bit afterwards is when I come off stage and run straight to the lobby to meet everyone. And then it's like the pressure's off. I'm just meeting friendly, like-minded people. I'm all hanging out and having a laugh. And had the greatest time. My son Hunter came with me. He worked the merch table. And really, I never feel happier than when I'm driving a rental car to a different province to do a show. The job that I love, the job that I cannot believe that I get to do, the job that statistically the chances of you decide you want to be a comedian. I mean, basically, I'd say there's a 0.001% chance that you might end up doing it 20 years from then, but certainly even less chance possibly that you would end up feeding a family doing that job. And the fact that I get to do it makes me so proud. But then I'm never happier than when my son, who it feels like seconds ago was a baby and was born, is now on the road with me, working the merch table, selling my books, because he gets a cut. He really pushes it. He is so good on that merch table. Someone comes up to buy a copy of my book and Hunter will be like, you sure you don't want two? My dad will be here later. He'll sign it. Just think of Christmas. Just think of birthdays. Wouldn't it be nice if he personalized it? He pushes it. He is such a good salesman, but it's just such a joy being on the road with him. Hitting up Subway at midnight to go back to the Quality Inn to watch episodes of SWAT. It was a great time. So anyway, thanks to everyone that came, and thanks to everyone that told their friends to come, because the audience was full of people that had never seen me before. And, nothing makes me happier than that. I'm going back to PEI this summer for the Small Halls Festival, doing a show at Mill River Resort and one in Charlottetown. It's just PEI. It's just so great. Less than 3 hours away, and you just feel like you're in another... You feel like you're on holiday every single time. I got back on Sunday. My wife and I sat down to watch a show I'd literally heard nothing about. And I'm embarrassed that I'd heard nothing about it, because it was the story behind it is just incredible. A Baby Reindeer, number two on Netflix right now as of time of recording. It is by a Scottish comedian who had some success in Edinburgh with an earlier show that he'd won some award about sexual assault and being and his own experience with this. And Richard Gadd is his name. Embarrassed to say, I knew none of this. I'd probably come across reviews of this over the years, but really didn't know much of this background. And this show, Baby Reindeer, is a composite of that earlier show about his the abuse that he suffered at the hands of a well-known television writer in England, and him being stalked by a lady who came into the pub where he worked. The character is obviously very much based on him. It is a truly masterful piece of art. This is unlike anything I've ever seen before. Beshev seemed completely unpredictable, like devastatingly disturbing, I will point out. So please, I mean, if you have been affected by almost anything traumatic in life, beware. Just devastating. I mean, oddly, also occasionally extremely funny, like laugh out loud, hysterically funny, and just consistently and profoundly kind of thought provoking. Many of the issues dealt with, I unfortunately relate to firsthand. And the fact that obviously the character is a struggling comedian and all of these kind of shitty above pub and below pub and basement gigs that he's doing are all exactly the gigs that I was doing and the competitions that he was doing, some of the venues that you see him in. So, I mean, I completely relate to that kind of feeling of just sheer desperation that this is never going to happen for you. And then going through these awful traumas. And then, of course, him being stalked, which became this Edinburgh show that he took to the Edinburgh Fringe Festival in 2019, which then led to, which again, it's just such an incredible story that it goes from an Edinburgh show, which is a one-man show, him on stage using audio and visuals of the messages that his stalker wrote to him and sent him and left him on his voicemail. 2019, 5 years ago, does an Edinburgh show, one-man show in which the stalker was an empty bar stall. It was just him on stage talking to an empty bar stall. Became a huge hit. It went on the West End in London. And obviously at some point it has now been adapted into this series that is quite phenomenally given the, I don't know if niche is the word, but the disturbing nature of it. It has exploded. I mean, I had, like I said, I'd heard nothing. And we go on to Netflix on Sunday and lo and behold, it's number two in the Canadian charts. It's got 100% Rotten Tomatoes review rating and it is completely perfect. And handles these issues very, very delicately, respectfully, responsibly. It deals with subjects of sexuality. There's also a trans character in it who he is dating, who is, thank goodness, played by a trans actress, which, as we know in the past, a very problematic thing that has happened in many shows is non-trans actors playing trans characters, which, again, not to say that people can't act as things that they're not, but it was refreshing to see a trans actress in this role. And it deals with these things with such sensitivity, right down to the fact that the stalker herself is treated with respect. Because as Richard has pointed out in interviews since, like, she's definitely not she's not a villain. Like, she is a victim of the mental health crisis facing pretty much every country in the world right now, and especially in a place like England and 100% in Canada, lack of resources, lack of funding, lack of understanding, completely lack of priorities by the government. She is a victim in it. And I love the fact that she isn't turned into a pantomime villain. She is treated, obviously her actions are terrifying, but she's treated with the utmost respect. And the fact that Richard Gadd, you know, went through this, wrote this thing, stars in it, has to relive it, his performance. I'm calling it here now. This somewhat oddly, weirdly underground British series, I think is going to clean up at the Emmys and Golden Globes next year. The two leads are going to do well. Jessica Gunning, who plays the stalker, is just a truly one of the greatest performances I have seen in years. I mean, she is phenomenal. So anyway, watch Baby Reindeer. I will talk at length at some other point, maybe in my book, about the subjects that the film addresses that did affect me. But this isn't one for a positive Wednesday Hump Day podcast. Another show I started to watch was Sugar with Colin Farrell on Apple Plus. Obviously not paying for all these streaming networks. Apple, we got a free month's trial for it. God, isn't it just annoying? These, like, so I'd read about this show, Sugar, and with Colin Farrell, and how it's kind of, you know, like he's like a private dick, and it's kind of like an old school, like LA Confidential style pulp noir. Very difficult for anyone to do film noir now after LA Confidential, because it was just such a perfect movie. I went to see Curtis Hanson's LA Confidential at the cinema the day it came out, Wickham 6 in Berkshire, where I grew up. Anyway, it makes it very hard. And of course, it's very self-referential, and there's lots of, you know, footage of, you know, of old movies, the Humphrey Bogart movies, the Cagney movies, all these things. I kept reading online how there's this big twist halfway through that will either wow you or literally make you angry. I start watching it and then realize that there's only 3 episodes up there because Apple are releasing them week to week. So literally the combination of Apple releasing, you've got the whole season, just drop it at once. I've got invested in it. Well, I've got to now wait a week for a 27-minute show, then another week. What is this, 1984? And then that combined with that money-grabbing bastard Bezos adding commercials to Amazon Prime movies and shows, we're going backwards. These bastards dragged us away from have I already talked about this on the show? Have I already banged on about this? They drag us away from network TV. They sink network TV. They dismantle the entire TV industry as we know it, creating streaming, because we're all too lazy to sit through commercials. And they go, look, you can have everything on demand. Blah, 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 blah. You just press the button, it's there. Have everything. You have everything now. Everything you want immediately. Right, you don't have to wait for anything in life. Right, you destroy all concept of patience. Right, it was funny, like, watching the movie Alien last night and seeing them on Monday night, seeing the slow burn aspect of it and the build up, and thinking, my God, this would no child would watch this now because of bloody TikTok and everyone's attention spans being completely dismantled by these poisonous tech evil mastermind. Just anyway, how would I get onto this? My point is that we've gone backwards. Well, I'm trying to watch a movie on Prime. I'm watching shitty commercials. Really, Bezos? What the Bezos is sitting there on 60 gazillion dollars, and he's still trying to come up with ideas to fuck us out of more money. I mean, seriously, surely, Bezos, surely there's a limit. Surely you could go, I've just funded this most new movie, Roadhouse, right? Conor McGregor, Jake Gyllenhaal, right? People are paying me a subscription, and I've got a gazillion dollars in the bank. I'll let people watch the movie, shall I? They pay the subscription, but no, he has to sit there and go, how can I get more money out of them? Maybe I'll sell some ads beforehand and I'll make people sit through them. And unlike on a good old VHS or a DVD, they can't fast forward through the ads. No, they've got to sit and watch them unless they give me more money. And then that combined with Apple making us wait a week to watch episodes, we've literally gone backwards. We should have not trusted. We should have just stuck to normal TV. Anyway, if you want to watch a phenomenal stand-up special that addresses the evils of tech, my good friend Nathan McIntosh, who is probably the most globally known comedian ever to come out of the Maritimes. He was on The Tonight Show with Jimmy Fallon last week. Fallon? Kimmel? Fallon? How do I still... I get mad at my wife for not remembering which is which. Fallon, there's the one that does the Oscars that's often very funny, and there's the other one that laughs a lot and doesn't do much else. I think it's... Anyway, Nathan McIntosh has a stand-up special called Down With Tech. It was filmed at Village Underground at the Comedy Cellar in New York. It is an hour of just wall-to-wall brilliance. He is lambasting these evil tech geniuses as a wonderful line. And you can watch his set on The Tonight Show. He was on The Tonight Show last week. I believe he was born in Miramichi, grew up in Nova Scotia, and often comes back here to perform at Punchlines and in St. John and Yuck Yucks in Halifax, which, by the way, I will be at in early May. 2 shows at Yuck Yucks Halifax, close bracket, ADHD kicking in big time, off the meds. Apologies for all the sidetracks and tangents. Nathan McIntosh's stand-up special, and he released one a year ago or 2 years ago. A year ago, New York Times picked it up as one of the best stand-up specials of the year, even though it was not that it was only on YouTube, but often when you self-finance and self-produce and self-release a stand-up special, like lots of us do, you don't get the recognition you deserve because, again, the evil tech masterminds at Netflix have this all locked down. But Nathan MacIntosh got a huge respect for that last one. And then somehow a year later, he's come up with a whole new stand-up special with another hour of brand new material filmed at Comedy Cellar. I actually saw him at the Comedy Cellar when I was in New York at the start of the year. Went there, massively lucky. Went to see him because I love him and he's a mate. And then Dave Attell, one of the greatest comedians of all time, was also on. And also we should watch Dave Attell. It was Dave Attell's special, Hot Cross Buns, on Netflix. Absolutely genius. And then who else was there? Andrew Schultz was there. So anyway, Nathan MacIntosh, watch his special. And another stand-up special that I just watched this week was Sean Walsh, who some of you may or may not know. He's a British comedian who was on the path to huge success. Got cast in Strictly Come Dancing, which is the biggest biggest TV show probably in the UK. It's up there with, you know, Britain's Got Talent and all that stuff. It's a dance, we know Strictly Come Dancing. And long story short, he had a little tabloid scandal because he was seen kissing his partner, his dancing partner, and they were both in relationships. And the vitriol that followed was so unprecedented, you would think that he had like burned down Buckingham Palace. It was the most insane thing. He was, basically he went from like hero to zero overnight. And as hilarious as this is for the evil tabloids and the evil, you know, to decimate this highly talented comedian and by all accounts very nice guy's life, and not to, you know, we all make mistakes is what I'm saying, right? I'm not endorsing what they did, but they made a mistake. They had a few drinks, made a mistake. It's a private thing. He was torn just apart and was considered kind of toxic property. Basic career went destroyed overnight. All over this kiss. And he released a stand-up special maybe 2 years ago called Kiss that was incredible about this whole thing. And he's just released a new one that just came out a few days ago, which I can't remember the name of. But my point is he released both of these on YouTube as well. Self-released, no publicity, no PR hired. And it's one of the most hilarious and eye-opening. And again, of course, I mean, it deals with subjects like his father was a heroin addict. He does an incredible impression of Michael McIntyre doing a routine about someone, their parent being on heroin. It's genius because not only is it a pitch perfect impression of Michael McIntyre, the routine that he then does, the genius of this bit is that the bit that he crafts in McIntyre's voice would actually be a very, very good. It's a brilliant routine in its own right. Anyway, has to be seen to be believed. Sean Walsh, I'm searching now on my phone to see what's it called. Oh, Sean Walsh is dead. Happy now? ? I honestly never laughed so hard. Just full of brilliant gags. A lot of for North American listeners, there might be a lot of British references, but he handles it like a master. So anyway, I guess my point is that you don't have to go to the streaming networks to get the best stand-up anymore. You might, you know, what the powers that be want everyone to think is that, you know, you've made it if you're on Netflix. Well, it's not the case. The best comedy can be enjoyed on YouTube. Some of the best stand-up I've seen in years, Sam Moyle being another example, even Andrew Schultz, I believe, released his on. The best stand-up that you see will be on YouTube and in your local comedy club. It's not in the arenas. It's not in the big festivals. And quite frankly, if you've watched the last few Netflix specials that I've watched, you'll realize that actually not only is it not the best there, it's often the worst. Moving forward, I've covered a lot already, but I've got a lot of questions to get through. Oh my God, you sent me some amazing questions, guys, which I'm going to get to in a sec. This Thursday, i.e. tomorrow, I'm at Long Bay Brewery with one of my final warm-up shows. Next Saturday night, I'll be at the Imperial Theatre doing my greatest hits. We're filming this one for stand-up special. We're recording it for an album. There's lots of big surprises. Ethan Ash is joining me. We have got big surprises in store. It's 100 minutes of my favourite jokes from my 20-year career. And this Thursday, tomorrow at Long Bay, we will decide once and for all which of those jokes is going in. I believe I'm right in saying there are 4 tickets left. So if you want to see me tomorrow night, intimate venue, very intimate venue. This is maybe my 10th gig there this year, probably 30th or 40th ever. Love it. It's the place that I experiment. You will hear me say things that I will never say anywhere else. Tomorrow night, Long Bay Rosse, join me. And I'm back there next Thursday with Ethan and then next Saturday night at the Imperial Theatre. Lots of messages from you about the announcement this week that the short film, The Peninsula, filmed almost entirely on the beautiful Kingston Peninsula and in many ways conceived due to our love of the Kingston Peninsula, directed, edited, cinematography by Tyler Warren Ellis, written by my son, Hunter. Could not be more proud. This is 3 years in the making. It was a COVID project. And Hunter had a great idea for a film. And I said, you should write it. And we were kind of in and out of lockdowns. And I believe a part of it was written en route to St. Andrews once. And I didn't help. Like, he came up with the dialogue. And there isn't much dialogue. It's a short film. And it's all about tone. And but he came up with the entire premise, every emotional development, every dramatic scene, all him. All I helped with was formatting the script. Tyler filmed, edited, sound mixed, directed, did all of that. Ethan Ash recorded the soundtrack. Katie Oram, who I had first met when we worked on a zombie movie a few years ago called Anonymous Zombie, where a very low budget movie, brilliantly directed by Richard McQueen, another great local director, and produced by Nathan Savage. And I met so many great people on that film. Kyle Wills, the amazing rapper Wills. We shared lots of scenes together. Met so many great people on Anonymous Zombie. But the best thing about that film was unquestionably KD's epic zombie makeup, which just blew me away. I actually drove home with the gore on my face once, and I got held up by there was roadworks going on Rosse Road, and I pulled up and the guy tried to stop me, and I had the phone and I was like, help, let me through. I was running late to get to a gig in Fredericton. I needed to get home, so I just, because I had all the gore on my face, he was like, go, wave me through. But yeah, Hunter wrote it. It stars Hunter and my amazing beloved father-in-law Barry, who delivers an incredibly, never acted before in his life, has no desire to, but will do anything for his grandson and his son-in-law. Barry Arthur is a complete trooper. The film, one of the scenes that involves the special effects and the gore that KD created involved Barry having to lie on ice in the hillside trail, actually, in Rosse, with his head on ice for about an hour and a half while we filmed this scene. Didn't complain once, didn't bitch, didn't moan. Just the greatest man. So kind to do that. And it's a short film, about 12 minutes. It's about despair and loss and friendship and kindness. And really, you know, it's a showcase for the Kingston Peninsula, completely self-financed. We received no funding, no support, no nothing. We all just chipped in and worked around the clock to do this thing. I'm just so proud of it. And it's going to be at lots of film festivals this summer. I hope you all enjoy it. Got lots of a few other TV projects on the go that is kind of exciting and stressful, in that I have... But there's one that I've been approached to act in, which is a sitcom that filming this summer, and we're just trying to make the dates line up. And I have three other shows that I'm currently developing, should we say, one scripted and two unscripted. So we'll see where those go. Okay, questions. Let's go through the questions. Okay, I've got so many lovely questions here, and I will definitely keep this podcast under 50 minutes. So, Sean and Jennifer Mooney, it is lovely to hear from you both. Happy to hear your recent episode. You had a blast in Montreal. Here's my question. The first time I became aware of your work was at a company Christmas party where you'd been booked. We had a great time, which has led to us seeing you in multiple venues over the years. I've heard other comedians discuss how corporate gigs can be a challenge. Bad time of day, the audience is drunk, tired, or not engaged. A bad location for stand-up. Without naming names, do you have any corporate gig horrors? Yes, horror stories. Yes, I do. Now, I will say from the top, corporate gigs in England are a bloody nightmare because the audience is all of those things you just described. Drunk, tired, but mostly just very, very drunk. And they behave like barbarians because that kind of behavior is accepted in England. In Canada, it is way less accepted. I have never had a bad experience at a corporate gig in Canada other than just me bombing. In the audiences, they might be quiet, but they've never been aggressive or shouty or violent or abusive. Whereas in England, the corporate gigs can be an absolute shit show of carnage and violence and bottles flying. And just because that kind of thing is somewhat accepted. Although I will say I did actually once, I guess the worst I've seen is I turned up for a corporate gig in Miramichi, and I won't name names, but it was a company in Fredericton. And as we know, you know how St. John is, when they want to misbehave and they need to get out of town, they go to St. Andrews to misbehave, which is a bit stupid because I thought that when I first moved. I'm like, oh, can't get away with anything around here. Come on, love, said to the missus, come on. Let's go to the Algonquin for the weekend, get away, you know, away from prying eyes, be a bit naughty, drink a bit too much. You get there, every fucker from here is there. So it doesn't really work. For Fredericton, it's Miramichi, that's where they go. And I turn up and it's a Fredericton-based company, very well-known company. And I arrive at this venue in Miramichi. And as I arrive, the boss is bundling a member of staff into a car, worryingly the driver's side, bundling him in, going, how many times have I told you, you can't be touching the women like that? Thought, holy shit, this is not going to be good. And it was not. Essentially standing in a corner, shouting over people. And it's such a weird thing, because of course, in a corporate gig, you're being generally, the brief is to be generally, for the most time, to be clean. So you can't treat, and you're there working for the company. So you can't treat them the way you would in a comedy club. In a comedy club, if someone gets out of hand or a bit rowdy or a bit chatty, you have it in your arsenal, and you also have the power and the permission to destroy that person, whatever it takes to get the room back to what they're all there to see, because people paid money to be there and they deserve a good show. So if you need to destroy someone, you can. Verbally destroy them. I mean, obviously not jump off stage and start Conor McGregoring them. Although I have been tempted. So generally in Canada, corporate gigs are always a joy. I love them. There are tricky aspects to it, like often the fact that, you know, you are performing these in a room that is not designed for comedy. You're in a soulless corporate function room. My complaints generally are very boring ones, like the tech isn't very good, or the lighting's not very good, or the audience is too late, the audience is tired. The two worst ones out in England, though, were I went up to Burnley. And I remember this, I was with my agent. I might mention this in my book, and in the movie The Comedian's Guide to Survival, that was based on my early years in comedy, this scene is depicted very, very vividly. Where we drove to Burnley, it was a day where there was a snowstorm, and not really a snowstorm, but they thought it was in England, and they shut the highways, they told no one to leave the house. And my agent drove me for 6 hours to Burnley, and we get there, and there's no seat, long story short, there's no seats for the audience, and the stage is basically at the opposite end from where everyone's standing. And I go in and I go, okay, you know, and then the CEO comes to the dressing room and says, you know, so we can get the brief and blah, blah, blah. And I said, well, what's the jig out there? What's the score? And he goes, they've had a tough year, lots of layoffs, so fucking great. And I said, okay, so, you know, just so I can get a gauge of how drunk they are, I go, is it open bar? And he goes, oh, no. It's been free booze every other year. And I was like, oh, well, why isn't open bar free booze this year? And he goes, oh, well, someone decided to spend the money on a comedian instead. I said, you what? He goes, yeah. I said, do they know this? Like, do they all know that there's no free booze because of the bloody hiring of bloody me? And he's like, oh, yeah, there's been a bit of argy-bargy about that one. Holy shit, I've got to go and perform for hundreds of people who know that I am the only reason that there is no free booze at their party. That is an unwinnable gig. And sure enough, it was a complete disaster. I mean, I won them over a bit. I kind of did a bit of a Bill Burr in Philadelphia thing and just basically started roasting the shit out of them, knowing that it was going to be a complete nightmare. And some of them liked it, some of them didn't. And it was just, when you kind of know, when something is already a disaster, you can kind of, I guess it's a bit like being in the trenches in the First World War. Yeah, yeah. Any heroic soldiers listening, they're thinking, oh, that's exactly what it's like. Yeah, getting paid good money to stand in a corner of a pub being shouted at for half an hour. Yeah, it's exactly what it was like, getting your limbs blasted off, watching all your friends dying around you. But a bit like being in the trenches, in that you, there's a bit of Blitz spirit, should we say. Dunkirk, yeah, anyway. That was another one I did. I did a gig for a load of estate agents, which would be realtors in England, where I walked on stage completely ignored, and I had to perform for an hour with literally not a single person in an audience of hundreds looking at me, all at these long tables, all just talking, and I'm walking up and down, and I had to stay on stage for the full hour or I wouldn't be paid. So I literally just walked up and down on stage, just talking to myself into a mic for an hour. It felt like a lot longer than an hour. So I hope that answers your question, Sean. But yeah, never had a bad experience here. And like I say, Atlantic Canadian, and indeed Canadian companies as a whole, when I do corporate gigs here, it's a joy. People want to be there. People are respectful. They love their companies. I think people are just happier in Canada in general. And they're happier with their jobs. And if they're not happy with them, they do something about it. But they make the most of a fun thing. And they're not all paralytic drunk, because that just wouldn't be accepted. I remember doing one for, was it T-Mobile or some mobile company in England. My God, it was, because I always ask the booker, are there any, like, I don't do anything offensive in my act, but is there anything I shouldn't touch, anything, you know, anything I should know? And then this booker clearly completely misunderstood me. And he was like, oh yeah, okay, here we go. This is for some mobile company, TTT, I think it might have been T-Mobile. Anyway, he goes, all right, yeah, all right. This was in Leicester in about 2010. And he goes, yeah, all right, now listen, her over there, she's a Muslim. You can go after her, they'll like that. I'm like, no, you've completely misunderstood. That is not what I do. But he wasn't listening. He's like, no, I think that, he goes, that bloke over there, he's a gay, I think. And I'm like, no, sorry. That was not what that is not what I do. And I haven't come to you for a list of traits of your staff so I can ridicule people's lives. That's not what I'm asking. And clearly they wanted some kind of old school right-wing racist homophobic comment to come comic, weirdly though, because I don't know why you would want to do that to your staff, but that is British CEOs for you. Anyway, on comedy, I have a question here from the amazing Caitlin Dean, a phenomenal human being, a phenomenal podcast. You should listen to her podcast, Living Large. It's hugely eye-opening, enlightening, profound, touching, all of the things that this wonderful woman herself is. She was for many years an amazing journalist, arguably one of the best that we've ever been lucky enough to have here. And she is now making her mark on the East Coast comedy scene, doing as many gigs as she can. And I haven't had the privilege or pleasure yet of seeing her perform. But since I love everything else about her, I have no doubt that I will thoroughly enjoy it. But I have heard from many people that she is basically becoming very good very quickly, which always annoys me because it took me years to get good. But seemingly she is already absolutely nailing it. So her question is, what is your pre-performance routine? Does it change depending on the size of venue show? Pre-performance routine is, to be completely honest, twitching. And I have numerous facial tics. I have numerous nervous tics. Some of them are vocal, which I've somewhat kept in check while recording these podcasts. But a lot of twitching, a lot of winking, a lot of really, if you watch me before I come on stage, you will think that I'm having a seizure. And depending on the size of venue, it doesn't really change. If I'm doing 45 people at Long Bay or 4,500 at Harbour Station, the nerves, it's lots of fiddling, drinking lots of water, going back and forth to the washroom to do numerous wees because I'm drinking so much water. So yeah, lots of twitching. I still went nervous in that I just really, 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 really want it always to go well because I live for this. Do I get more nervous for hometown crowds or away crowds? What are my comedy goals? What lovely questions. I get nervous everywhere. I definitely get more nervous for hometown gigs in the, you know, you're going to get more nervous when, you know, if I want to do well everywhere, but if I bomb in BC, I'm on the next flight out the next day. So really, like, you know, there's no... But if I bomb in St. John, this was my thing when I moved here, which really made me work hard, was knowing that everyone in the audience, I would have to face them at the school gates the next morning or in Sobeys. I definitely work very, very hard to make sure that every show I do in Atlantic Canada, or specifically the Maritimes, is really special. And especially in St. John, full of surprises, because I want everyone to leave going, holy shit, that was way better than we thought it was going to be. Because it just means everything to me. And I also know how hard it is to get out of the house. And I want people to make an effort when I go to their shows. So I do. So next week at the Imperial Theatre, there is a huge, I don't want to spoil it, there's a big surprise, which I hope makes people go, okay, we laughed for an hour and 40 minutes. And so I definitely get more nervous for hometown gigs. And you know, I mean, and generally it goes well. I had one disastrous gig here that I still have nightmares about that I actually just wrote a big chapter on for my book. If it keeps cutting out, I'm really sorry, my stupid computer keeps going to sleep, and I really hope it doesn't stop recording when it does that. So if it has been cutting out, that's why. I'll fix it next week. We'll make sure it doesn't go to sleep, whatever. During COVID, the wonderful people at Area 506 conceived a way to do the festival, you know, safely, responsibly, in what they call pods, but they were kind of scaffolding cages. And it worked wonderfully for music. It worked appallingly for stand-up. And it was a devastating experience standing on stage, looking out at 1,000 people who'd kind of, in a lot of cases, spent a lot of money on tickets. They couldn't really hear me. Looking out at faces of people I know, not really laughing, kind of looking pityingly at me when I kind of struggled through. That is a gig I have nightmares about. And it was COVID, and we had to, you know, there was other gigs that you did during COVID that somehow worked brilliantly, like the drive-in gigs. You know, against all the odds, worked well, but you took chances during that period, and you tried to do your best, and sometimes it works, sometimes it didn't. What are my comedy goals, Caitlin? I'd love to hear yours, because as I say, by all accounts, you are rocking and rolling it and doing spectacularly well very, very quickly. So, and by the way, Caitlin, you've been such a good friend over the years, but I remember about 5-6 years ago, you brought a gang of people to see me at the Best Western Plus. Best Western Plus, not just the Best Western, it's got the plus in there. Best Western Plus in Woodstock, and huge gang of lovely, lovely people. You introduced me to them then. And anyway, I saw some of them last Monday at the Chris Hadfield event, and we were all singing your praises. So if your ears were burning last Monday, it was me and your Woodstock friends all saying how much we love you. My comedy goals are just to literally maintain this. Like, I never in a million years thought I would ever wind up in a position where I did this for a job. Never stop appreciating it. And I literally work around the clock to try and make it so that now, 20 years in another 20 years, I can still be playing same kinds of size venues, being able to, you know, a little surprise. I got approached this morning for a festival in Alberta. I haven't performed in Alberta for 10 years. And so to get an email out of the blue asking me to headline a festival in Alberta, these little surprises come in every time you kind of feel a bit down, or you feel like you've been overlooked for stuff, or you feel like you're not getting opportunities that other people get. Suddenly these little surprises come up. But really the bare reality of it is being able to go to Summerside in PEI and do a show to, you know, room full of people for 2 hours, and they will laugh and chat afterwards. I mean, it's the dream. And I love everything about it. And yeah, that's really my comedy goal, is to be in... Seinfeld had a good example when Seinfeld referenced another comic saying to him, you know, how he wanted to get into movies because he didn't want to be 60 years old and performing in Milwaukee on a Tuesday night. And Seinfeld was telling me this story. And at the end, he said, I couldn't believe this comic was saying this, because he was like, I do. That's exactly what I want. I want to be performing in Milwaukee on a Tuesday night when I'm 60. And you know what? Respect to Seinfeld. He's well over 60 now, I think. He might have $1 billion in the bank, but he is still performing in Milwaukee on a Tuesday night. And I basically want to be, and what am I now? 46. Caitlin Dean is actually my birthday twin. We both were born on 11th of March, as was Kate Milbury, another St. John legend. So my answer is, my comedy goal, Caitlin, is to not be playing Milwaukee on a Tuesday night when I'm 46 now. So my dream, Caitlin, let's log this down. My dream is, in 20 years, when I'm 66, I want to be playing Sussex and New Brunswick on a Tuesday night. Few more questions. Tim Andrews, my British friend who now lives in Nova Scotia. Seriously, what do you think of maritime driving standards? Tim, I am not in a position to criticize anyone's driving. As my wife constantly reminds me, I'm the worst driver, partly because I only learned to drive about just before moving to Canada. Never needed it in England. A, because of public transport, trains, buses. You just don't need it. And you don't want to have a car and you can't afford a car. Also, because back then, I never wanted to do anything that didn't involve the consumption of alcohol. So there was no point me having a car, because I didn't go anywhere to do anything that didn't involve boozing. So I'm not a very good driver. I only learned to drive when Pam was pregnant with Hunter, because if I told this story already, I probably have. Anyway, she said that she didn't want to get a taxi. They told us to get a taxi when she went into labor. And Pam's like, I'm not getting in the floor of a taxi in labor. I'll drive myself. And I could not. And I'm not really someone that goes in for masculinity or any of that bollocks. But I couldn't cope with the idea of arriving at the hospital and the doctors and nurses running over and opening the passenger door, expecting a pregnant woman to get out, and instead me climbing out and the pregnant woman being in the driving suit and me having to go, oh, sorry, just thought I'd get a ride with the woman in labor who's just broken water. So I learned to drive very quickly. And as my wife often says, she says, she drives us everywhere. Whenever we go on holiday, anywhere we go, she says, the only time you'll ever see the two of us in a car together and me behind the wheel and Pam in the passenger seat is if she's drunk. That's it. That's the only time. So, I will say there's a lot of shitty drivers here, Tim. There's no doubt about it. Although there's a lot worse drivers in England. And of course, the other thing is, we're so spread out, so no one's really had to get used to driving in traffic. If people drove the way they do in the Maritimes in London or Toronto, there'd be a gazillion more accidents. I love going into... What is it with Walmart and people parking over? Somehow people have mastered the art of parking over like six parking spaces. Karen Dean, wonderful Karen Dean, brilliantly talented writer. I have her book right here. We Are Unbreakable, Women in Nova Scotia in 2020. An amazing woman. I met her amazing daughter. Karen has asked, I know that you're happily married, but I'm sure you hear lots of people talk. So any dating advice for a single 50-year-old woman? Also, do you have any amazing guy friends who are single? I'm sure I do. Men out there, I don't think there's many perverts listening to my podcast. I don't think it's that kind of place, especially not 52 minutes in to my... I don't know, maybe actually 52 minutes into Mindy's Weekly Ramble is the worst place for pervert. Sorry. So anyway, anyone listening to this, I suspect you, I probably know you personally. Almost certainly I do. If anyone knows any great men over, they don't need to be over 50. Karen might be 50, but she looks 35. So any great single men over 35 looking for a hugely talented writer, great mother, great celebrator of all things maritimes, don't message Karen and bug her on Facebook. Write to me and I'll vet you. And if I think you're all right for her, I will pass on her details, but I have used her full name. Maybe I shouldn't have done that. Leave Karen alone. Write to me if you're interested. Mullinger's Dating Services. Mullinger's Weekly. What could it be? What could it be called? Mullinger's Weekly Matchmaking. Imagine if Karen met a man through. Is it a man you're after? Yes, guys. Imagine if Karen met a man through my podcast. That would be just the best thing ever. I've had some success at this. Jen and Dwayne came to see me for their first, second and third dates. They ended up married. Another couple had their first date to see me at the Astor Theatre in Liverpool, Nova Scotia. And then 2 years later, he proposed during my show at the Chester Playhouse. So I've got some form on this. Karen, you're awesome. And do I have dating advice? Don't meet men through my podcast. Would be funny. I think it sounds twee, but you're great, and there are great people out there. And 50 is probably the best time for it, because this is the point that, you know, potentially around this time you've got kids leaving home, couples are realizing that they hate each other, and they've got nothing to talk about now. The kids are gone, so they're going to break up, and you've got these great guys that just didn't gel with the woman that they accidentally married when they were in high school, and now they're going to be available. And I think there's going to be great people. And also, you live in Nova Scotia. I mean, there's got to be tons of great guys in Halifax, and I will do all I can to help. So my dating advice, you don't need advice, Karen, just be yourself. Any man you meet who you like, hand him your book, because really, I think that's my best dating advice, is that you need to be with a man who is not just as strong and as awesome as you, but you need to be with a man who who respects strong women. So my advice to all people listening to this would be, gift a potential suitor, because now I'm a matchmaker in the 1700s, give it a potential suitor. It isn't how you say it, is it? It's S-U-I-T-O-R, but why when I say it does it come out suitor? If you are in Downton Abbey, potential suitors. Sorry, my head keeps turning away from the mic, which is highly unprofessional, but I'm not a professional. Karen's book is called We Are Unbreakable, Women in Nova Scotia in 2020. Give a potential suitor Karen's book, or indeed any book by that book, definitely, and then another book by Amazing Strong Woman. What other amazing book can I think of? Well, I'm looking at books here. I've got The Feminine Mystique there by Betty Friedan. I've got lots of books by Bell Hooks. I've got my amazing friend, Nancy Regan, from Showing Off to Showing Up, who actually, it was through Nancy that Karen and I met. And by the way, Nancy Regan's book, From Showing Up to Showing Off, is available now on audiobook. So everyone should listen to that. So dating advice, Karen, give potential suitors copy of your book, and if they are as in awe of the amazing, powerful, brilliant women in your book as the rest of us are, then they're probably a decent guy, because they respect great, strong women. So my brain is all over the place. I am aware that, like, obviously a lot of this is ADHD, and part it's just that I think I am personally committing mental. I mean, I was like last night, I was picked up my son from school. I was giving his buddy Will a lift home. And they're 13 now. When the kids hit 13 and you're mates with their mates, they're not just their mates anymore. They're your mates, aren't they? Is that fair to say? I think so. So yeah, he's not just my son's mate. He's my mate. I was giving my son and my mate Will a ride home. Now, I've given him numerous, I've dropped him off at his house millions and millions of times, right? It's near my house. It's so easy to remember. I remember hours and hours of stand-up. I remember, yet for some reason, I can't never remember his road. I always pull in at the wrong road. Put in the wrong road, the one before, the one after. I'm like, where is it? And we always have a bloody laugh about it. Anyway, as my son would say, my bad, bro. I don't know why I was, last night we were having a laugh about that. And I said I would mention it today on the podcast, and I have. Final question before I leave you all. It's Philomena of Philomena and John. Luckily, we saw you at Joker's Comedy Club in lovely Richmond Hill, Ontario, and have been the fortunate recipients of your thoughtful and personal communications ever since. Love every single outreach. Well, thank you very much, Finland. It was so lovely to meet you after the show. And I love keeping in touch with people who I meet after shows. I have some questions for your podcast that you may answer at your leisure. Well, thank you very much, Finland. Thank you. Well, maybe I'll do some of this fiber. What's my wellness routine? How do I stay fit? Pacing, I understand, is the workout of the future. But do I do more? I do a lot. Not particularly intensively, but I have an amazing personal trainer once a week, and which is great for strength. Not so much that you would be able to see it in my physique, but it's useful to do. The great thing with the personal trainers, of course, you know, they get you to do things that you would never normally do yourself. Or have the knowledge to do yourself. But my daily routine when I'm home is the YMCA, which I absolutely love, the YMCA of St. John. I love the place. It's beautiful. It's clean. It's spotless. The people there, the people that work there, the community of people I've got to know there. And they're often the people, and they often cheer me up, because I often go in there feeling quite down first thing in the morning, and swimming is my thing. Swimming is my thing. I'm not a very good swimmer. I do, essentially it's breaststroke, but really it's kind of a combination of doggy paddle and breaststroke and some kicking. But I'll do like 20 or 30 lengths, and it's how I clear my head, get ready for the day, wash away all those kind of like negative thoughts. And every now and again, some lovely lady will come up to me and say that she's listening to my podcast, and it'll make me suddenly feel happy, because I'm pathetic like that. And those things mean the world to me. So people just say nice things, or like they come and think, oh, I saw you on the social last week. And it's just nice. And you get to chat to people, and it's lovely. How do I stay so well organized? You remember everything and follow up so thoughtfully. Well, maybe, I don't know if I'm that well organized. I will just say, Philomena and John, you're both just such lovely people. Of course, I was going to stay in touch. I do keep ruthless lists, so I remember everything I need to do. But that's how I stay organized. And I'll read your third of your, and then the other two questions I'll do next week. How do you stay so incredibly grounded and personal, as you are all about people first? Well, that's a really lovely thing to say. And I guess it is a question, even though it is also just a really lovely compliment. I guess I stay grounded because I'm just a grinding, jobbing comedian. There's no success necessarily to speak of, other than the success of doing a job that I really like, having a family that I love and being around them a lot. And that's it. And there's really nothing to not be grounded about, because there's no, you know, what I do, I traipse around, I stay in, you know, for the most part, you know, occasionally I get to stay in gorgeous, beautiful hotels, like certain places, but for the most part, I'm staying in, you know, budget hotels, driving cheap rental cars, you know, living off Irving sandwiches. And, I do a job that I love, and I love making people laugh, but there's no room for ego in Canadian showbiz when you are the bottom rung of the ladder. But I don't need there to be, because, like I say, this was the dream, and I'm living it, and I'm grounded and personal, because it just stems from a genuine love of people and meeting people and appreciation for everyone. So thank you so much, Philomena and John. You know what, there's two more questions there that I'm going to quickly do. We know you have incredible energy. Do you get exhausted, and how do you manage it? I do get exhausted. I have naps, and I guess this is the blessing. People always say to me, you're so busy. It's like, well, I am. But equally, when I had an office job, for some stupid reason, outside of Europe, bosses do not respect people napping during the day, which is frankly just undeniable, a steaming pile of bullshit, because every now and again you need a nap, and you ain't getting much done in a workplace if you're like sat there dying for a nap. So I'll occasionally take a 15-minute nap, and I'll come back swinging. And I just wish more offices would respect that. And then, you know, in Europe, obviously, you know, bottle of wine for lunch, hour siesta, back to work. Although I don't know if that's necessarily the answer. Your final question, and this is what I will leave you all with, is Philomena asks, I worked in the special education field, and you're having ADHD is challenging, I'm sure, but at the same time, you're an inspiration. I don't think I am an inspiration to many, but very kind of you to say. What would you say to yourself, to those struggling with expectations? I guess, for want of a better phrase, it really is about lowering expectations. Don't have expectations, but don't have expectations. Just have the things that you want to do. And if you want to do them, you will get them done. And like everyone, I mean, I have this same ADHD, mindset where I wake up and there's a million things to do and I'm running around and I'm kind of doing half doing or quarter doing all of them, but not actually really finishing any of them. And you're not getting anything done because you're running around panicking. You're getting distracted. I'll do this. I'll see this. I'll hump into the dishwasher. I'll start an email. I'll do all these things. And then suddenly you panic do things and you panic and you rush them and you do them too quickly. And then afterwards, then you've got this kind of feeling of the dopamine hit in your brain and suddenly you're all happy because you've done this thing. And then you have a crash and then you're kind of worrying about the state of the world and the universe and what's the point of life and why were we put here and how are we supposed to get through life, not knowing where we came from or where we're going or why we're here. And you have this kind of existential crisis. And that is my daily routine. But ultimately, I guess the way I see it is the stuff gets done. And don't set unrealistic expectations. Make a list and work your way through it. And the list just helps you not forget things. But don't beat yourself up if you don't get them done, because things can carry over to the next week. They're still written down. They're still going to get done. So lower the expectations. Just make the list. Make the list and do what you can. And don't do what you can't do. And remember, the things popping up all the time. So if you get nothing done off the list, well, you still have got other things done because other things pop up. And also, there's things that are going to be there that you need to do, like emptying the dishwasher, that aren't on the list. So I hope that's helpful. Thank you all so much for listening. Thank you for your questions. This has been Mullinger's Weekly Ramble. Please do email me, comedy@jamesmullinger.com, if you would like your questions answered. I will see you all next week. Have a wonderful, wonderful weekend. And thanks for listening. Love ya.
Mullinger's Weekly Ramble.